So let's get started. So here's going to be an overview of my work. So I'm going to define this concept called the Baum-Curry complexity. It's a variant of the usual quantum Curry complexity, which I'll also tell you in just a second. And it's kind of a new way to look at quantum algorithms. So first of all, I'll explain what the Elitzur-Veyman Baum tester actually is, and we'll show how that leads to the concept of Baum-Curry complexity. And finally, the main result is that the Baum-Curry complexity, B of F, is closely related to a quantum Curry complexity. Afterwards, I'll show that this main result can be used to construct quantum algorithms that are superior to known ones. So I'll start by showing that we can non-constructively prove the existence of Gilbert's algorithm for the Rolle function. And then I'll actually show how we can construct quantum algorithms from classical ones by plugging into this formula. Right, so let's continue. So in the Elitzur-Veyman Baum tester, we think of the following scenario. So imagine that we have a bunch of bombs, and some of them are duds because they're broken, some of them are live. So each bomb, though, you interacted by shining a photon on it, and if it's a good bomb, the bomb explodes. If it's a bad one, then nothing happens. Can you hear me back then? Back there? Okay. Yeah. So now the question is, we won't want to be able to test these bombs without blowing ourselves up. After all, we want a good bomb to preferably still be there after we shine a photon on it. And classically, this seems impossible, but with quantum mechanics, you can do something like the following. So you place this bomb in the Max Zender interferometer. So on the left-hand side over here, if the bomb is a dud, so it's as if there's no object. So you put a photon into a beam splitter. You send one branch into the dud, but nothing happens. And so the two branches interfere together, and you only get something coming out of the detector D1 in the picture. On the other hand, if the bomb is live, then when you send the branch into that bomb, the bomb explodes, so that branch is destroyed. The other branch, however, gets sent into a beam splitter, and then you get something coming out of detectors D1 and D2. So what happens here is that if detector D2 detects a photon, then we know the bomb is live. But the bomb has not exploded because it went through the lower branch in the picture that didn't go through the bomb. So in this case, we detect that the bomb is good, even though the bomb hasn't exploded. So this seems pretty mind-blowing to me. I don't know if it is to you, but it turns out we can actually do better, and we can get it to arbitrarily high accuracy or arbitrarily low probability of explosion. Before I get to that, though, let me rewrite this in the circuit model. Are we familiar with the circuit? Are we familiar with the circuit model over here? Yeah. So interrupt me if there are any questions. So over here, we add an extra control qubit on the top to decide which represents whether the photon travels through the branch that goes through the bomb or not. And we do something like this. So if the bomb is live, controlled on the photon going through the branch that goes through the bomb, we apply an x on 0, and then we measure. And so if we measure 1, then the bomb explodes. On the other hand, if the bomb is dud, then nothing happens, and we just control an i, the identity. So now here's how we can get the explosion probability at arbitrarily low. So this was work done by Kreat and a couple of other people in 95. So let r theta be this small rotation in the x basis. So we start out in the state 0 in the control qubit. We rotate it by a tiny bit, and then we apply the bomb. And then afterwards, we rotate by a tiny bit again, and we apply the bomb again. And we do this and on the order of 1 over theta times in total. So what happens here is that if the bomb is a dud, then the bomb actually does nothing. And all the rotations just rotate the qubit all the way from 0 to 1. And that's it. On the other hand, if the bomb is live, then we always project the first register back to 0 on each measurement. Because once we rotate it by a little bit, and then we control the bomb, if the first register is in 1, then the bomb explodes. And that's the end of everything. So this, in effect, is a projection that always projects the first register back to 0, with probability theta squared, or sine squared theta, which is order theta squared, this fails and the bomb explodes. The total probability of explosion, though, is only theta squared times 1 over theta, or the order of theta. So in summary, we can tell whether a bomb is live or not with at most a probability of explosion of order theta if we use 1 over theta queries. OK, yeah. Now let's get to quantum query complexity. Does everyone know what quantum query complexity is? Should I be skipping this? OK, well, in quantum query complexity, we want to evaluate a function on a string x given as a black box. And you want to use as few queries as possible. So a typical circuit looks like this. We count the number of OXs, or the number of black boxes used in the circuit. And well, we basically care about it because it's usually easier to deal with than time complexity. Because there are powerful methods of finding the query complexity of things. And we don't really know how to lower bound the time complexity of problems other than relating it to the query complexity. So yeah, ask me to slow down if I'm going too fast. So yeah. A black box in the quantum query complexity model looks like this. So we apply the black box Ox, which is dependent on a hidden string x. And so we have two registers. One holds the answer, and the other one holds which location we're trying to query. And the output is we add the bit xi to the record register, R. Now I'm going to define what I call a bomb query in the following. And the intuition for this is that we say we have a string x. And now I'm just thinking of, like, I want to recreate the situation with the Letzer-Weyman bomb tester, where we now tie a bomb to every bit of the string. And we want to evaluate a function f without setting off the bomb. So in some sense, with Glover's algorithm, for example, it would be something like we have a bunch of, say, n exits, and each exit might have a bomb or might not have a bomb, and we are only armed on the Mach Zehnder interferometer and want to see if we can get out of there alive. So here's a bomb query. The difference from a usual quantum query is that, first of all, I add an extra control register. It's analogous to having the beam splitter in the original picture. And this change on its own isn't very substantial. It doesn't actually change the quantum query complexity. However, the next two changes do. So the second change is that before I apply the black box, I need to store zero in the input. So I need to store zero in the record in the record register where I'm going to hold my answer. Now afterwards, after I measure the query result, after I apply the query, I immediately measure the result. And if I ever get 1, then the bomb explodes and the algorithm fails. So if we look at the circuit, this happens when the control bit C is 1, and also when the bit XI is 1. So it's like we are tying a bomb to each bit And the ice bit is a life bomb if Xi is 1, and it's stored otherwise. Yeah, so later I'm going to rewrite this in the following way. So the above circuit is actually equivalent to just projecting the control bit to 0 when Xi is 1. So essentially, the bomb explodes if C times Xi is 1. So this effectively projects us into the subspace where 1 minus C Xi is 1. And in the model I define, bomb curve complexity, a typical circuit would look like this. So we apply one unitary U naught, and then we apply the bomb query, P, which I call PX0, and then apply another unitary, and I apply the bomb, and so on. And then we count the number of times the bomb is applied, and we want this number to be as small as possible. So I call the minimum number of bomb queries that I need to determine some function f with bounded error, but with the bomb exploding with no more than probability of epsilon. I call that the bomb curve complexity B epsilon of f. Sometimes I'll drop epsilon as well, and I'll just say that it's a constant, say 0.01. So the first main theorem that I show that, well, that I describe is that the bomb curve complexity is actually tightly characterized in terms of the quantum curve complexity. So it turns out that B of epsilon f is actually the quantum curve complexity Q f squared over epsilon times some constant. And so to prove this, the upper bound uses the quantum Zeno effect that I described earlier. The lower bound uses the adversary method. So the upper bound basically goes the same way. So if you want to tell whether a bit xi is 1 or not, we basically use the quantum Zeno effect. So we rotate the state 0 slowly towards 1 if xi is 0, and slowly to and it stays at 0 if xi is 1. So that's what the left box is doing. Afterwards, we add the result to the actual record register that we wanted, and then we uncompute everything in the second half. So we do the reverse of what we did in the left box, in the right box. Okay, so if we do this pi over 2 theta times, each time we do this, so this circuit over here simulates one quantum query. And we take our quantum circuit and then just replace every query with this construction. Now, each time we do a quantum query, there's a theta chance of explosion. And we do this Q of f times. So the total chance, if you want to make it bounded by a constant epsilon, then we need theta to be epsilon over Q of f. The total number of bomb queries is, well, for each circuit, we need 1 over theta queries, as we also described earlier. And we do this Q of f times. So in total, this is Q of f squared over epsilon. Now, that was the upper bound in terms of quantum complexity. To do the lower bound, I'm just going to describe it. It's rather involved, but straightforward. So we use the general weight adversary method due to Hoyle and coworkers. So we know that there's this measure called the general weight adversary bound that tightly characterizes quantum curve complexity. So in theory, you could get any lower bound on curve complexity using this method, but it's difficult to use. By modifying the proof that this gives a lower bound to quantum curve complexity, we can show that the square of it actually lower bounds the bomb curve complexity. So this shows that the bomb curve complexity is just the square of the quantum curve complexity over epsilon. So that was the first section. Let me continue the algorithms. So let's start with considering the following scenario. So there are N bombs, and we want to check if any are alive. So it's actually pretty straightforward to come up with a linear time bomb query algorithm for this function, which is essentially the OR function. And we basically just check each bomb using 1 over epsilon queries, or N over epsilon queries in total. So each bomb has an epsilon chance of exploding if it's live. But if it's a dud, then there's no chance of exploding. And since we only want to check if any bomb is live or not, we just stop at the first live one. And so the total chance of exploding is only epsilon. And so B of epsilon OR, we showed that there's an algorithm for it that runs with N over epsilon queries. OK, but what does this tell us? So we show that B of OR is O, is O of N. So this, of course, using our main theorem, shows that Q of OR is O of square root of N. So this actually gives an unconstructive proof of Grover's algorithm. So somehow Grover's algorithm came into this picture. The question is, can we generalize this further? And since I'm asking this question, the answer is, of course, yes. Before I do that, though, let me describe a symmetric variant of the bomb model, which I'll use shortly. Essentially, over here, I add an answer, I add a guess, I add an extra register, which is A over here, which allows me to guess what the query result is. And the bomb explodes if my guess is wrong. And it turns out that I can show using the first main theorem that this is equivalent to the original bomb query model.
I guess I missed something.
Yeah.
I'm confused about what you showed was that if there's a query algorithm, I mean, if the query complexity is Q of F, then there's a bomb query complexity of at most Q squared of F.
It's actually exact. So, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so,
that's both a low bound and an upper bound. That's exact.
Yeah, but did you say why it was the other way as well? So I missed that.
So there's the upper bound comes from the
right
Clonsky effect. The lower bound comes from the adversary method. So
oh, okay, right, okay, yeah, okay, got it. It would just run by kind of fast, but okay, go ahead.
Okay.
You didn't give the whole argument. It's just
no, I just said it could be done. It's actually straightforward. We actually just went to Hoyer et al.'s paper in the negative weight adversary method, and then we basically repeated the steps but changed things into a model.
Okay.
So it's straightforward. Yeah, so this is a symmetric variant where we allow an extra guess A, and the bomb model explodes if we guess wrong. And it turns out that if we use the main theorem, then it's easy to, it's straightforward to show that this model has the same query complexity as the original model. So I'll be using this model in the next theorem. So the main theorem is this. So suppose we have some algorithm A that computes a function F using at most t queries. And this algorithm A is classical. Moreover, assume that A doesn't need to make that many mistakes. So there's an algorithm G that can just guess the results of each query that A makes. So it's either 0 or 1. And G, well, script G makes at most unexpected G mistakes. And it turns out we can construct a bomb query algorithm with complexity T times G. And so the quantum query complexity is the square root of T times G. And for example, for the OR function, in the algorithm I just constructed, the number of queries we need in the classical algorithm is just n because we check all of them. However, if we always check that each bit is 0 or that each bomb is a dud, then we only need to make at most one mistake before we end the algorithm. So g is 1. And so the quantum query complexity is just n times 1 or square root of n. So I'm going to give two proofs of this result that I just described. One goes to the bomb query complexity, which was the original way of thinking about it. And afterwards, we also came up with an explicit quantum algorithm to do the same thing. So to go through BOM query complexity, we basically repeat the same argument in the case of the raw function. So for each classical query, we are going to check whether G, whether algorithm G predicts the query result of A using G over epsilon BOM queries. And of course, if G guesses incorrectly, then the BOM might explode with probability epsilon over G. Otherwise, the BOM doesn't explode because we guessed correctly. And so the total probability of explosion is just epsilon over G times G, which is epsilon. The number of BOM queries used is G over epsilon for each original quantum query, for each original classical query, times the total number of classical queries, which is T. So this is T G over epsilon. So this shows that B of F is TG, and so Q of F is square root TG. Now, for the classical algorithm, it's a bit more involved. We first need the following subroutine, which is that we can find the first marked item in the list with square root D queries, where D is the location of the first marked item. And a simplified version, I think I'm telling a slight lie here, but a simplified version of this is you essentially do binary search. So if you search the first item to see if any of those are one, and then you search the first two items, and the first four items, and the first eight items, and so on. And then you stop until you hit something, and then you zone into it using binary search. That's the essential idea. So yeah, here's the explicit quantum algorithm that actually gives us the given query complexity. What we'll do is we will take the classical algorithm A out, and we're just going to simulate all its queries. We're just going to write down all its queries, which we can determine faster using a quantum computer than actually checking them one by one. And then we'll just use the classical algorithm A running on these queries, and that gives us an answer. So what we'll do is first we use the quantum the prediction algorithm G to predict all remaining queries of A. So we'll just list everything up under the assumption that it makes no mistakes. This uses, of course, no queries to the actual black box. What we do next is we use the previous classical algorithm, the previous quantum algorithm to find the first marked item to search for the location of the first mistake that G makes. This uses square root dj minus dj minus 1 quantum queries that look the distance from the last mistake to this mistake. And this actually determines the actual query results up to that query. And then we erase everything afterwards. And then we repeat until we're done. I'm going to go through an illustration of this in just a sec. So yeah. Robin Kothari, who was at IQC until a year ago, actually gave an algorithm for the Oracle identification problem, and it basically uses these steps. So it fits into this paradigm. So yeah, here's an illustration. So for example, in this case, we first use G to predict all queries of A at the very beginning. So G might say that A is going to query position 2, and G guesses that the answer is 0. Under this assumption, A is going to next query position 5, and G guesses that the answer is going to be 1. And then, assuming that this happens, A is going to query position 4, and then G guesses that the answer is 1, and so on and so on. And this determines everything. So, of course, G is probably going to make a mistake at some point. So, we basically drove a search for the location of this first mistake. So in this case, when A queried location 3, the answer is actually 1, not 0. So we changed that. And then this tells us that everything up to that was correct. And we don't know about anything after that, because A might change the locations of the queries it wants to query. So we fix everything up to the mistake that G made, and then we start over again. So G guesses that after querying position 3, that A will query position 10 and get a result of 0, and then query position 1 and get a result of 0, and so on. and then we find the location of the next mistake, and then we fix the query results to that mistake, and so on and so on. So yeah, the total query complexity of this is O big O of G, which is the number of times we run this, because we expect to make G mistakes on average. And so this, the G loops in the algorithm, times square root T over G, because that's roughly what the distance between two mistakes are. There are a total of T queries that I need to make, and I run this for G rounds. So on average, the distance between two mistakes is T over G. And this is order of square root T times G. So this is a rough estimate. I can make this more precise using Cauchy-Schwarz. So it looks like error reduction might actually give extra log factors because I'm running Grover, which has some error, and I need to do error reduction. But Kothari actually showed that the log factors can be removed using a technique called span programs. So yeah, I can now finally I can actually apply this to some graph problems. So the first thing we tried this on is a problem called breadth-first search. So we can consider that we have an unweighted graph as a black box, the JCC matrix of an unweighted graph, and we want to find the distances from one vertex S to all other vertices. So classically, you do this by the algorithm known as breadth-first search. So you first set the distance of S to be 0, and then you look at its neighbors, and then you set the distances of those neighbors to be 1, and then you look at the neighbors of all vertices with distance 1, you set those to distance 2 if they haven't been set, and so on and so on. So you just check the closest ones, and then check the next closest ones, and then check the next closest ones. Yeah, so the worst case query complexity of this classical algorithm is n squared. We might need to check nearly all the edges in the worst case. However, if we check that each queried pair is not an edge, we only need to make at most n minus 1 mistakes, since once we set the distance of one vertex, we don't need to ever check any edges that might lead to it ever again. Or to put it another way, in computer science language, there are n minus 1 edges in the spanning tree. So yeah, so the quantum query complexity of this is square root t times g, which is m to the 1.5. And this matches the lower bound of Durr et al. No. 4. They actually give upper bound that's n to the 1.5 times some log factors. What we show here is essentially that the log factors don't need to be there. But here's a problem that they didn't look at, which is what if we want the distances from k different sources? So we're given k vertices, and we want to find the distances of those vertices to everything else. So the classical algorithm we're going to use in this case is just to run breadth-first search k times. Now, quantumly, the number of guesses is k times the number of guesses, so it's k times n minus 1. The total number of queries, though, is still n squared. You don't multiply that by k, because you never have to query each edge more than once, and there are only n squared edges. So if you want to query something that you've seen before, you just return the old answer. So the quantum query complexity of this is square root t times g, which is square root k times n to the 1.5. And it turns out that this is tight, and this was shown by two MIT students, Dari Rao and Mayer, and it's available in Scott Aronson's blog. Now finally, we also apply this to maximum bipartite matching. So matching, we can think of a matching as in the bipartite graph in the following way. So we have, say, n boys and n girls, and they're all heterosexual. And given each pair, we can query to see if they're compatible, if they're willing to marry each other or not. And then we want to find the maximum number of marriages we can get out of these boys and girls. So classically, there's an algorithm that does this called the Hopkopf algorithm. It runs in n to a 2.5 time. This proceeds essentially by using square root n rounds of breadth-first search and a modified version of depth-first search. So quantumly, the number of guesses that we need is square root n times n minus 1 times some constant. which follows from before. The BFS, we know that each iteration we need n minus one wrong guesses, and DFS is similar. However, the total number of queries we need for the classical algorithm is still n squared, because you never need to go above that bound. So the quantum Curie complexity is just square root t times g, or n to the 7 over 4, and n to the 1.75. As far as we know, this is the first non-trivial upper bound that beats, well, this trivial n squared upper bound where you just query everything. So yeah, it turns out that our algorithm actually can be used for something. So the summary is that inspired by the Litzer-Veyman bomb tester, we define the notion of bomb query complexity, and we show that it actually characterizes the square of the quantum query complexity. Following from that, we obtain a general construction of quantum query algorithms from classical algorithms. If there's a, shall we call, predictable classical algorithm, then we just turn the crank, and then it gives us a quantum query algorithm. And this, in particular, gives us the first non-trivial quantum query algorithm for maximum bipartite matching. And now some open problems. The first question, of course, which every computer scientist I've talked about this asks, is whether we can relate g, the number of wrong guesses, to certain classical measures of query complexity, like the certificate complexity and the sensitivity and the block sensitivity. If you don't know what that is, that's fine. Another series of obvious questions to ask are whether these algorithms can be made time efficient. We don't know that yet. Whether we can come up with algorithms for the adjacency list model, so a graph is expressed as a list of edges instead of a matrix. And whether we can generalize this to other problems, like matching for general graphs. Now finally, the question I want to ask is whether we can find a relationship between classical query complexity and bomb query complexity. And the reason I'm interested in this is the following. So we know that for total functions, which is a function defined on all possible 2 to n strings instead of a subset of them, we know that the largest known separation between R of F and Q of S is quadratic, which is just given by Grover's algorithm. And we conjecture that this is the extreme case. And I think this conjecture has been open for like 15 years or something. Now, of course, we know that B of F is just Q of S squared. So this conjecture is just saying that R of F is upper bounded by B of F. And we can actually show some motivation for why this conjecture is true. So it turns out that Scott Anderson, in around 2002, had considered a similar model to ours. And basically, he does the same construction, but he doesn't measure the result. But he doesn't explode the bomb if he measures a 1. So he has a controlled quantum query, and he measures the result. But the purpose of the measurement is just to decohere the part that's 0 and the part that's 1. And so we call the number of queries we required in this model the projective query complexity. And what's nice about this model, or why he looks at that, is that this actually separates the Grover speedup from the speedup from, say, Shor's algorithm. Because in Shor's algorithm, in the original formulation of it, right after you make a query, you immediately measure the result of the query. So this doesn't actually slow down Shor's algorithm at all. But as Regev and Schiff showed in 2008, this actually destroys the quantum speed of a Grover's algorithm. So we also know that we can immediately see that the projective query complexity lies between classical and quantum. It's intermediate in strength. And also that it's upper bounded by the bomb query complexity because, well, you don't explode the bomb, so it's only going to be easier. And since this looks so much similar to the classical case, essentially the difference between this and the classical case is just that there are negative probabilities allowed in this. The open question that I'm asking is that, is it true that the projective query complexity is is asymptotically equal to the classical query complexity for all total functions. And of course, if this is true, this implies that the classical query complexity is upper bounded by the Baum query complexity, which is upper bounded by Q of F squared. Yeah, thanks.
So, I mean, one downside of using these adversary methods is that they're not, maybe in some principle they're constructive, but most of the time they're not constructive.
They're not constructive.
In principle, I think from spam programs, but it's not practical. Do you have maybe some, in this particular case, you were able to come up with an explicit explicit algorithm for doing for the guessing thing. You have some hope to do that more generally for these Baum?
In general, I don't know. Given a Baum algorithm, I don't know how to turn it to a quantum algorithm.
Uh-huh.
And I think even for general adversary method, it's also non-constructive. So if you have a lower bound, that doesn't translate to a spam program, because the semi-definite program is non-constructive.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but in this case, which is maybe what people are going to care about because it allows us to get algorithms, we can find a quantum algorithm for it.
So this conjecture between the classical query complexity and the quantum query complexity. I don't know much about this, but I found a paper by Aronson and Ambanis, where they claim in the abstract that there's a problem that you can solve using one quantum query, whereas you need at least a quarter square root of n divided by log n.
So I think you're talking about the correlation function.
So
the reason that that doesn't break this conjecture is that that function is not total. So by a total function, I mean a function that's defined on every single string from, say, 0 to 2 to n minus 1. And for example, Shor's algorithm for order finding doesn't fit into this paradigm. Isn't a total function. And that's why we can get a super polynomial speedup in that case. Because we know that R of f and Q of f are related polynomially. We just want to shrink the degree.
So, do you know if you can improve that matching algorithm? Is there any lower bound?
I've thought about it. I haven't gotten anywhere. I think that upper bound is probably closer to n to the 1.5 than n to the 1.75. So there's a lower bound, but it's n to the 1.5. So there's still a gap. I think that it should be improvable. I don't know how to do so.
Anything else? Nothing. Let's thank the speaker again.